KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
We see this in all kinds of ways across the country that people have used local government to try to push back against corporate power and to actually build systems locally that they control. And so I think part of the reason I'm excited about this growing anti-monopoly movement is that it's a chance not only to counter corporate power, but inherently within it, a chance to think about how we can get government back that actually works for us.
There are local tools that we're used to using that we can use on Amazon that we just have to sort of build a little bit of spine to do. Connecting with folks who are doing that same type of organizing all around the country is really, really key so that we're sort of connected in a way that starts to make us a more formidable force against this huge company.
In the second of our two-part program, we join Tom Hartman, Stacy Mitchell, and Maurice B.P. Weeks to survey the landscape of rising antitrust movements to break the stranglehold of corporate power and level the playing field for a democratized economy. This is Democracy versus Plutocracy, Part 2, Breaking Up is Hard to Do. I'm your host, Neil Harvey. According to Jeffrey Winters, the author of Oligarchy, wealth in the U.S. today is over two times as concentrated as Imperial Rome, which was a slave and farmer society. If billionaires were a nation, they'd be the world's third largest economy. As Fortune magazine CEO Alan Murray has observed, more and more CEOs worry that public support for the system in which they've operated is in danger of disappearing. Indeed, from local communities and states to federal policy, antitrust movements to dismantle monopolies are challenging the system that can be summed up as make feudalism great again.
Amazon hosted this kind of game show-like search for the best city to build their second headquarters in, and the way that the contest worked is basically whoever could give them the most tax giveaways or benefits was going to be the city that they chose.
Maurice B.P. Weeks worked on one of the most explosive and high-profile campaigns to resist and challenge Amazon. He's co-director of the Action Center for Race and Economy, where he works with community organizations and labor unions to create equitable communities and dismantle a monopolistic system he calls racial capitalism. The campaign erupted in the borough of Queens in New York City, which is among the most diverse and low-income in the nation. Maurice B.P. Weeks spoke online at a Bioneers conference.
So from leaked documents and some public documents, we know that cities were offering all sorts of things, you know, no income tax by Amazon employees for 35 years, no property taxes paid at all, we'll build a rail line for you, all sorts of things that cities were offering. And when Queens was chosen, you know, I think the residents there realized a couple of things. One, this isn't really a good business partner to have in your neighborhood. So there's lots of diverse businesses in Queens that have been there for lots of years. And one thing that we know that happens when Amazon comes into a particular place is they suck away both the labor market and just drive down the quality of the actual area while not paying any taxes into that area in order to upkeep other things. That, along with, you know, the company having no response to things like them having contracts with ICE or other policing entities. The areas that they were looking at going into were filled with immigrants, either first or second generation immigrants. To have a neighbor coming in, this huge corporation that is so aggressive towards immigrants with their contracts with ICE, just wasn't something that was possible. And frankly, New York City is, along with lots of other states in this moment, there are lots of financial needs there in schools and roads and parks, and there's a lot of financial need. I think communities correctly agreed that it just doesn't make sense to give giveaways to the one of the wealthiest corporations on earth run by the richest man on earth when we could instead fund our schools more, you know, fund our train system more, et cetera. So that's a little of why the Queens pushback happened. That was a higher profile, and I will say that both Amazon and Google and other companies really do this all of the time.
For Stacy Mitchell, the Queen's Rebellion was deja vu all over again. As co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, she's been battling the same players in the same matrix ensnaring local communities nationwide. She's produced many influential reports and articles and testified before Congress, and she's been seminal in some of the antitrust actions dogging Amazon.
There is this growing focus on structure, economic structure, and on policy. And this sort of, we've been living for a number of decades here, imagining that big companies have been taking over and growing in size and power simply because they were better at what they did, right? They were more efficient. Like every time you walked past the corner drugstore that had closed its doors or another workplace that had gone out of business, another, you know, small town somewhere that was struggling, you just sort of assumed that this was like the price of progress, the natural evolution of companies taking over that were just better at what they did. And what's really true, and what a lot of our research and other research shows, is that in fact, what has happened is that we've written a set of policies that have favored these companies extraordinarily. And as they've grown, they've been able to manipulate government further and further and further to their own advantage. I mean, Amazon has picked up over $4 billion in local and state subsidies. You know, governments across the country writing Amazon checks. You know, if you're a local hardware store and you want to open a second location, like, good luck getting a dime from your city council. You'll be laughed out and told that this is a free market and you have to compete, right? Meanwhile, your biggest competitor is getting these huge subsidies. And that's not all. Amazon didn't collect sales tax in most places for over 20 years, an incredible advantage. And we see them even today in the midst of the COVID crisis, you know, not actually stepping up and providing protection for the employees that are in their warehouses the way that they're really legally obligated to do and certainly ethically obligated to do. And our anti-monopoly laws, the fact that we really shelved our antitrust laws 40 years ago, has been a whole set of tools that, again, has fueled the exercise of power. So the pushback in Queens that Maurice talked about and that we're really seeing at the grassroots level across the country is this growing focus on, you know, it's not just about calling these companies out for their bad behavior and trying to get them to do better. It's about recognizing that this is our government and we own these rules and we need to change these laws and we need to think about, well, what does an economic structure look like that actually serves a democracy and that actually serves the needs of people?
So how did we get here? Beginning in the 1960s and 70s, the lawyer and later failed Supreme Court nominee Robert Bork launched a full frontal attack against antitrust law. He shifted the focus from fair competition to a matter of efficiency and price points. If customers were getting a cheaper price, then monopoly was just fine. He marketed the phrase consumer welfare so successfully that in 1971, the famous Powell memo by the Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell redefined the metric for judging monopoly down to price points. Bork teamed up with Milton Friedman of the rising Chicago School of Economics and neoliberalism. They asserted that corporations were accountable only to shareholders, not to employees, communities, or the environment. This radical shift was contrary to the original intent of antitrust law, which was to protect small businesses, fair competition, and democracy itself against the concentration of great wealth and power. Beginning in the 1980s, the Reagan administration started systematically dissembling antitrust law and dialing down enforcement. That trend has continued full tilt boogie ever since, landing us in today's world of giants and dwarves. So how'd that work out? Pretty much the way you'd expect, says progressive radio talk show host and author Tom Hartman.
I think the most important thing, though, is educating people. I don't think most Americans realize that the average American family pays a $5,000 a year monopoly tax. Americans pay twice as much for cable television as any other developed country in the world. We pay two to three times as much for cell phone service. We pay more than twice as much for Wi-Fi. We pay more for airfare. We pay two to 10 times more for pharmaceuticals. I mean, the list just goes on and on. We're spending a lot more for a lot of things than anybody else, any other developed country in the world anyway, does, because they enforce their anti-monopoly laws and we don't. So I think this step one is waking people up, educating people.
Data show that monopolies smother the economy. They drive down wages, raise prices, throttle small and independent businesses, damage local communities and economies, and stifle innovation and competition. The predicament is that they're now so embedded in the economy that they compose a kind of private infrastructure that people depend on. But there's another way to approach this dilemma, says Maurice B.P. Weeks.
I live in the neighborhood where most of my neighbors are elderly and at high risk for contracting the coronavirus in a way that would be a real health complication for them. And they've been ordering a lot on Amazon, a lot of stuff, everything from kind of regular groceries to paper towels to things to keep them busy in the house, et cetera. And they love it too. That's the other thing. They, you know, everyone gets excited when they're getting an Amazon package. They love the company. But the fact that there's an infrastructure that exists so that we could get things that people need to them quickly at a time where they can't get them themselves, that's actually great. And they built it using really, really shady and not so great strategies, but now it is there and we can actually, we can take it, we can use it, we can do a lot of the things that they're doing. Whether it can be operated in the way that it currently is, at the size that it is a real question, to which personally I think the answer is no. We have to break it up and we have to have some sort of more democratic control over it. You know, of course, controlling for, we don't want to pay the workers crappy wages. We want it to be safe. We don't want it to be harming the environment, et cetera. But I think that there are things there that prove that this is a piece of infrastructure that we can use.
It's not online commerce or, you know, the cloud or any of the other industries that Amazon controls. It's the fact that those things are controlled by this single unaccountable player that operates essentially above any kind of law. That's the problem that we have to address, not the technology, not how much we enjoy online commerce and its convenience. That's all great.
Stacy Mitchell's work on decentralizing and democratizing the economy led her to testify before Congress. For the first time in decades, the House of Representatives began looking at resuscitating antitrust law. A year-long investigation of big tech resulted in a scathing report in 2020.
And they found that these companies, Amazon, Google, Facebook, and Apple, are in fact monopolies, that they have monopoly power, that they exercise that power in ways that harms people and harms independent businesses and communities. And then they lay out a set of recommendations. And essentially, with regard to Amazon, what they've called for is exactly how we handle the railroad. So in 1906, we passed a law that said, look, if you're a railroad, that's fine. You can't also own other companies. Like, you have to be a neutral carrier, a common carrier. You can't have a financial interest in commodities, because then you're going to favor your own commodities over those of those who need the railroad. And that's what we should do with Amazon. We should say, look, you as an online platform needs to be separate from Amazon as a retailer. AWS needs to be spun off, and their logistics infrastructure. They've now built a logistics operation, a shipping operation that rivals UPS and even the Postal Service in scale, but that also needs to be spun off as an independent company. And that Amazon, when it's functioning as critical infrastructure, needs to be subject to a set of public oversight laws.
But needless to say, breaking up is hard to do. Like the railroads before them, big tech funds the best government money can buy, including Congress. Stacy Mitchell says much of the real action has already been happening at the local and regional levels. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance published a guide called Fighting Monopoly Power that details actions states and communities can take.
It goes through a whole range of tools that people have at the state and local level, some of those that I just named, but also things like starting a public bank, which your city can do and can be a great way to begin to untangle our financial system from Wall Street and begin to build locally controlled banking systems that work with community banks and with local credit unions to actually channel our capital where it needs to go to create the kinds of businesses and jobs and economic development that we need. We can, you know, enact rules that eliminate subsidies. There are just tons of powers at the state and local level. And we see that in the hundreds and hundreds of municipalities that have built their own publicly owned broadband networks and told Time Warner and the other Charter and the other giants to go away. we're gonna have better internet at lower cost. We've seen it in places like Oklahoma and other states that have passed referendum blocking corporate ownership of farmland and taking action against some of the big ag monopolies. We see it in places like North Dakota, where they've said that you can't operate a pharmacy in the state unless you're a pharmacist. So every pharmacy in North Dakota is a locally owned independent business. And we see this in all kinds of ways across the country that people have used local government to try to push back against corporate power and to actually build systems locally that they control. And I think when we start to look at the economy through that lens, we can see all the ways that we can begin to shift things.
There are local tools that we're used to using that we can use on Amazon that we just have to sort of build a little bit of spine to do. So ensuring workplace safety in a particular municipality can pass a law that just does that in the way that you want. You can still continue to do your local organizing, but connecting with folks who are doing that same type of organizing all around the country is really, really key so that we're sort of connected in a way that starts to make us a more formidable force against this huge company.
Maurice B.P. Weeks and Stacy Mitchell are part of a coalition called Athena, which is taking on Amazon. Along with advocates, policy experts, and academics, Athena is a group of 40-plus organizations whose communities and livelihoods are negatively impacted by Amazon. Athena's stated aim is to break up the power of Amazon and other mammoth corporations and recreate a world where all people, our environment, and our economy are healthy and sustainable, where everyone is safe, respected, and able to thrive. When we return, we look from the local to the global as antitrust movements start to upend the monopoly board. I'm Neil Harvey. You're listening to The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature. Visit bioneers.org, where you can explore hundreds of articles, interviews, and videos that we publish each year. Subscribe to our newsletters and podcasts, and check out deep dives on the topics that matter to you most. You can also learn more about the annual Bioneers Conference at bioneers.org. Although breaking up is hard to do, we've broken up monopolies before. When the Nixon and Carter administrations used antitrust laws to break up the AT&T telephone monopoly, it vaporized the corporate propaganda campaign that it would harm shareholders and 401ks. Instead, one share of stock became seven or eight shares. Shareholder value increased. But today's big tech companies have taken monopoly to a dizzying new level. Harvard professor Shoshana Zuboff calls it surveillance capitalism, the title of her influential book. Tom Hartman, Maurice B.P. Weeks, and Stacy Mitchell say that these days, Big Brother is not only watching you.
Amazon is in the perfect position to know what people are buying. They're selling stuff from small businesses, which is their sales pitch, right? We've got, you know, half of our business is small businesses flowing through us. But what they're doing is they're very carefully looking at which one of these small businesses are actually doing pretty good so we can just screw them, wipe them out, and start, you know, find some manufacturer to make the generic version of what they're selling and, you know, put them in the ground.
You know, Amazon sells its own goods as a retailer, where it's buying goods from suppliers, selling them on its website. It also manufactures its own private label goods, so there are thousands of items that are Amazon-branded goods.
Stacy Mitchell.
And it hosts on its platform all of these third-party sellers. And those third-party sellers are, you know, independent retailers, they're major brands, you know, big companies that you would know, small companies, there are a bunch of them overseas, you know, all kinds of different sorts of businesses. And what that enables, if you want to sell online right now, because Amazon is getting so many people right out of the gate, so many eyeballs right out of the gate, you know, your choice is either you can hang your shingle out on the World Wide Web on your own, have your own site, but it's like, you know, you're like on a dirt road that few people are actually traveling by and ever finding you, or you can become a seller on Amazon. And if you become a seller on Amazon, you are giving to your most ferocious competitor everything of value that you have. You're giving them your relationships with your customers, you're giving them your knowledge of the particular products that you sell. And they, because they own all that infrastructure, not only for e-commerce, but also we can talk about it, Amazon Web Services, and increasingly Alexa, their sort of voice operating system, all of those pieces of infrastructure give them this godlike view of everything that is happening across the economy. And from that vantage point, they can pick off hot selling products that some business has found and start selling them themselves and demote that business in the search result. Or they can simply use their gatekeeper power to raise fees. And so, you know, what we found is that the businesses that are selling on Amazon's site are increasingly having to pay a bigger and bigger cut of their sales. Today, about one out of every $3 in sales that a business makes on Amazon's site, they have to pay to Amazon. That's up from 19% just a few years ago. So this is a company that governs our markets, that effectively levies a tax on our trade. And if you have a problem with it, you know, the judge and jury, again, is Amazon. So again, back to this issue of control and power.
Along with corporate capture of government law and regulation, equally important is capturing people's minds. Although Tom Hartman says educating the public is a critical piece of the solution, what do you do when mass media and the internet are also monopolized and manipulated by giant corporations?
So, you know, we have, you know, a handful of corporations now that control the public dialogue, and then sitting atop that, or perhaps under that, like the roots of a tree, kind of the substrate or subsurface of that, you've got Facebook, which has, you know, I'm personally of the opinion that Mark Zuckerberg is the most powerful man in the world and is able to influence public opinion similarly. And I never saw any really aggressive conversations about net neutrality there either, although that those would tend to be more scattered. But we need to take this on systemically, top to bottom.
Maurice B.P. Weeks.
It's not just an economic power, it is also a political power. And that power doesn't just come from the amount that they give on the books to legislators. There's a real fear of going after Zuckerberg, going after Bezos, being seen as going after one of these companies. You know, folks are really scared to take them on. And we end up with these things like we'll allow Facebook to empanel their own review of their practices that they get to pick the people on and then decide whether they want to implement the changes that they, you know, these wacky things are like, well, you know, it'd be easier to just have government do that. But we're so, you know, we're so afraid of these sort of too big to regulate companies that we don't do anything.
That may be changing. The European Union hit Google with billions in fines from 2017 through 2019. But these are just rounding errors for the nearly $2 trillion corporation. More significantly, Australia passed a law forcing Facebook and Google to pay news publishers for their content. South Korea forced Apple and Google to open their app stores to alternative payment systems, threatening their 30% gatekeeper commission from developers. Turkey is demanding that Google stop favoring its own properties in local searches, a critical issue with major financial consequences both for Google and its would-be competitors. In the U.S., a series of ongoing whistleblower leaks and scandals have continued to turn up the heat on big tech.
The House Antitrust Subcommittee's work and the investigation that they did this year, one of the really electrifying moments in that was they had a hearing in late July where they had the four CEOs, Jeff Bezos and the others up there. You know, many of the hearings that we see, there's a kind of deference that lawmakers give to these CEOs, a sense of like, I don't really understand technology, but you do, and you're powerful, and all that sort of like, and you're letting them to grandstand. And this committee did not have any of that. They made it very clear that these companies are subject to the law and subject to accountability in terms of how they just conducted themselves. If one of the CEOs was not answering the question and was starting to like wander off and do a PR thing, they just cut them off and moved on politely, but you know, just really clear cut. And they brought in all of these voices of ordinary people, small business owners, workers, other people who'd been harmed, and gave them, you know, people who they'd uncovered as part of the investigation really gave them voice during the hearing. And so I think part of the reason I'm excited about this growing anti-monopoly movement is that it's a chance not only to counter corporate power, but inherently within it, a chance to think about how we can get government back that actually works for us.
When Jeff Bezos returned to Earth from his 15-minute vacation in space on his corporate Blue Origin rocket, he gleefully thanked Amazon employees and shareholders. They had just paid $5.5 billion for his 4 minutes hanging out at the edge of outer space. It wasn't rocket science for the world to grok the clueless lunacy of the moment.
I've tried to explain something like Bezos' wealth to children before, and you know, the saying is, if you stacked $1 bills just of his wealth, you'd be way past the space station by the time you were finished tapping. They get a huge PR boost when they give these tiny, tiny, tiny percentages of their wealth to solve problems that they are actually contributing to. So Bezos, you know, just recently made a lot of headlines by contributing to a climate fund. Amazon is one of the worst polluters, of course, in America, you know, probably the world.
And I think we need to deal with the sociopathy of great wealth. A number of these people are just literally screaming sociopaths.
Democracy versus plutocracy, part two. Breaking up is hard to do. With Maurice B.P. Weeks, Stacy Mitchell, and Tom Hartman. You can visit Bioneers.org to explore more of our media and subscribe to our podcasts and newsletters. Executive producer, Kenny Ausubel. Written by Kenny Ausubel. Senior producer and station relations, Stephanie Welch. Host and consulting producer, Neil Harvey. Producer, Teo Grossman. Program engineer and music supervisor, Emily Harris. My name is Neil Harvey. Thank you for listening. This is program number 248.
Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
We all remember our childhood birthdays, a kind of second Christmas when you were made to feel special. As we grow older, birthdays can inspire a degree of nervous reticence as we seek to avoid paying too much attention to our passing years. These days, I do enjoy sharing the joy of my grandchildren as they clock up their formative early years. It's not often that you get to celebrate a 450th birthday, but I did just that when, As ambassador in London, I was invited to attend Shakespeare's big birthday bash in Stratford some years ago. As the most senior envoy in attendance, I'd been asked to propose a toast to the local bard on behalf of the diplomatic corps. The roster of seven speakers at the bard's elaborate lunch included the novelist Hilary Mantel, who told me about her Irish heritage and of her desire to set a novel in Ireland, which, alas, was never written. As the last speaker, I was wary of being the postprandial diversion for an audience that I knew would by then have been generously plied with good wine. But when the cocksure individual who spoke just before me managed to go on for 30 minutes without even a mention of the venerable birthday boy, I began to hope that my brief remarks might come as welcome relief to the gathered Shakespeare devotees. I recognised that I might be an odd choice to celebrate such a quintessential English icon. But then again, to quote something President Higgins said when visiting the Royal Shakespeare Company during his historic visit in 2014, we Irish were the first people outside of Britain to enter into dialogue with the English language. That makes Shakespeare an indispensable figure for us too, one who has inhabited our imaginations for centuries. He continues to fascinate us with his beautiful phrases, his insights into the human condition, and for helping us, in the words of another English writer, to see into the life of things. My own initial Shakespearean exposure came at the age of 14, when Henry IV Part 1 was part of the syllabus for my intercert. I still remember with fondness the antics of Prince Hal and the roguish Sir John Falstaff, and can recall many lines from that play. I know you all, and will a while uphold the unyoked humour of your idleness. And, while you live, tell truth and shame the devil. Good advice, that. At our wedding in India in 1982, I recited Shakespeare's Let Me Not to the Marriage of True Minds Admit Impediments. Love is not love which alters when its alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. Let me hasten to add that I also recited Yeats's fine wedding-appropriate poem, He Wishes for the Clouds of Heaven, Tread Softly Because You Tread on My Dreams. Yeats, our national bard, saw Shakespeare as an artist who presided over the birth of a new species of man. And James Joyce was obsessed with Shakespeare. The characters gathered in the National Library in Ulysses, all highly knowledgeable Shakespeare enthusiasts, indulge in a deep, dense discussion of Hamlet. Joyce even refers to the possibility that Shakespeare might have been Irish, but alas, our genealogists seem to have drawn a blank on that score, for now at least. In Finnegan's Wake, Joyce pays Shakespeare the ultimate tribute of including him in his holy trinity of literary idols Dante, Gouty and Shopkeeper, a.k.a. Dante, Goethe and Shakespeare. When his friend Frank Budgeon asked Joyce which book he would take to a desert island, Joyce replied, I should hesitate between Dante and Shakespeare, but not for long. The Englishman would get my vote. Writing to mark the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's birth, our great playwright Sean O'Casey commented that he loved all things, he missed nothing, for nothing was too lowly for him to touch, with a beautiful phrase. The English language may have been acquired by the Irish as a byproduct of conquest, but today it's something that we share with huge numbers of people all over the world. And that's why, on that day in Stratford-upon-Avon, I was happy to pay homage to William Shakespeare, the first man of literature, treasured property of the world of words. I will almost certainly never attend another 450th birthday, but will be happy to celebrate my own 70 in the coming months in the company of my family, and there'll be no need for speeches. But I will probably call to mind a poem Yeats wrote around the time of his 70th birthday. What then, sang Plato's ghost, what then? The work is done, grown old, he thought, according to my boyish plan. Let the fools rage, I swerved in naught, something to perfection brought. But louder sang that ghost, what then? What now? Time, perhaps, to sail to Byzantium, metaphorically at least, and mull over, in Yeats's words, what is past, or passing, or to come.
Had I the heavens embroidered
It was 11 o'clock in the morning when we pulled into the little square in Custuriaco and parked in the shade of a tamarisk tree. Stepping out of the air-conditioned car and straight into the hairdryer heat of a Cretan morning, we glanced around, trying to get our bearings. The drive from Paliahora had been beautiful, and the last 10 kilometres or so up the perpendicular narrow trail truly breathtaking, in every sense of the word. Now here we were, Custuriaco, a tiny village with a noble history, and perched more than 500 metres high in the majestic White Mountains. I'd first come across the name Custuriaco when I'd read The Cretan Runner, George Sikondakis's extraordinary story of the Cretan resistance during World War II, when the author himself had fought side by side with war hero and famous writer Patrick Lee Fermor. The stories of Nazi brutality in Crete are legion. I'd heard so many war stories over the decades as I returned again and again to visit this lovely island. The robed, grey-bearded Orthodox priest who strolled the streets of Paliahora in the mid-80s had been, so the story went, the head of the local resistance. Then there was the old man who ran a caffinion, a cafe, situated right on the bend as you headed south out of the town of Kandinos. Deutsch? He asked me tentatively, the day I visited with my father in the early 90s. No, we said, Irish. And then, upon discovering that my father had fought with the British in North Africa, he fell upon him like a long-lost brother, before taking him through to the kitchen to show him a framed certificate on the wall, from the Allies, recognising his services during the war. Kandinos, of course, had been obliterated by the Germans. Some hurts truly never heal. Over the years, however, as I learned more about Crete's war history, I had been drawn to the story of Custuriaco and its famous Patarakis brothers, and to one incident in particular. This is what happened. In reprisal mode in 1943, German troops swooped into the village and, finding the men dispersed to the mountains, rounded up all the women and children, herding them into the square to face a firing squad. As the commanding officer was about to let rip with the machine gun, a shot rang out, and he fell, slain, in the square. Then, as the gunshots rained down, the execution squad fled from the village. The shots had come from the men who had gathered on the high cliffs above Custuriaco, and it was Kostas Patarakis, one of the 6 legendary Patarakis brothers, who had fired the fatal shot. Kostas, Manolis, Georgios, Vardis, Adonis and Vasilis, all are legends of the Cretan resistance, the Patarakis name still whispered among the elderly, like some kind of a sacred incantation. It was Manolis Patarakis, after all, who played such a vital role in the famous kidnapping of General Kruipe, later the subject of the film Ill Met by Moonlight, starring Dirk Bogarde and our own Cyril Cusack. Wow, I remember thinking when I first read about Custuriaco. Just imagine being in the village square that day, sure that you were facing certain death, only to be saved at the last minute, and by one of your own. Reading about it was one thing. Actually visiting the place was another. And now, on this hot summer's morning, I was here at last. We had stopped at the war memorial at the entrance to the village, and now, in the village itself, we thought we'd stretch our legs and get a cup of coffee. We looked towards the run-down caffinion on the square. An old man was sitting on a chair out front, fingering his worry beads and pulling on a cigarette. The cafe door was closed, and chairs were upturned on the tables inside. Nothing doing here. Then we noticed the women, all elderly, sitting sewing together under a shady umbrella of trees. They smiled. We smiled back. Then one of them, like a petite little bird, set down her sewing, hobbled to her feet, and waved us over. She shook hands with me, and then with my husband. Cafe? She asked. Yes, we said, that would be great, as we looked around for another caffinion that we must have missed. She waved to us to follow her. Out of the square, down a narrow street, turning right into a dirt-covered track, and along to the end we strolled,
before she opened a gate and in we went, finding ourselves in a beautiful garden. It was her own house. Indicating for us to pull up a couple of chairs to the small table there, she bustled off into the kitchen. A few minutes later, out she came with a box of biscuits and a steaming pot of coffee, and there we sat, the three of us, sipping, silently, in the sunshine. I tried to ask her about herself. Her name? Sophia. Was Kustoriako her home village? Yes. Had she lived here since she was a little girl? Yes. Was she here then when the woman and children were taken into the square by the Germans, I asked, when the men of the village were on the cliff top? There was a lot of sign language going on, including me pointing back to the village square and using my fingers like a gun. She nodded. Yes, she'd been taken to the square that day. A teenager, I guessed, judging her age with my eye. I followed her into the kitchen to help bring more coffee. Inside her small, tidy house, there was a huge black-and-white photograph on the wall. A man. A handsome man in his late 30s. Maybe his 40s. I pointed to my own wedding ring, to her, and to the photo on the wall. Yes, she nodded. And then her eyes filled with tears, as overcome by the memory of her now-dead husband, she tried to control her emotions. Back out again in the sunlit garden, my husband asked if he could take her photograph. She smiled and nodded, reaching out her hand for me to join her in the picture. "I'll send it to you," my husband told her afterwards, trying to explain that he needed her name and her address. Yes, she understood that, and so, drawing herself up to her full, tiny height, she proudly declared, "Sophia Patarakis, Kriti." When you're the widow of one of the legendary Patarakis brothers, I suppose that's all the detail you'd ever need.
When they poured across the border, I was cautioned to surrender. This I could not do. I took my gun and vanished. I have changed my name so often. I've lost my wife.
It was a small but heavy glass candle holder in the shape of a star. I pushed it up against the prayer to St. Peregrine Laziosi, patron saint of malignant growths, and I lit the candle. It wasn't my candle. In fact, I'd never lit that candle before that night. It was my mum's. She'd been diagnosed with cancer. I don't think I knew it was cancer at the start, but in 1989, no one said that word. She was sick for months. There was only the three of us, her and me and my dad. And Mum decided she wanted us to go on the diocesan pilgrimage to Lourdes in May. We weren't sure she'd be fit for it. And Mum said something quietly to me about last family holiday together, but I think I ignored that and kept on talking. And May came. I was doing my finals in university, and it was decided I was better staying put and studying. So I didn't go. On the Thursday, I left Mum and Dad off at the car park where the coach was leaving from. Dad in his usual shirt and tie. Her in her brown velour tracky bottoms, her sick woman's trousers, as we used to call them. And as the coach pulled out and headed for Dublin Airport, I went back to student life in Belfast. Meanwhile, they arrived safely in Lourdes and reported back that there was great colour in the town because of the huge numbers of uniformed soldiers and sailors from around the world on the international military pilgrimage, which happens at the same time. So they spent Friday down around the Basilica and the Grotto and sent a few postcards to family. On the Saturday, though, Mum took sick, and by tea time she'd deteriorated. I came back down to Newry. Dad was on the phone. I'd never heard him crying before. And that's when I lit the candle. And I waited. And the phone rang again about 9:30, and Dad said, "She's not good. Drive up to Belfast and stay with your uncle tonight. Don't be on your own." And I thought, well, I'll leave the candle and I'll let it go out on its own. And then I was concerned that it would catch fire, so I lifted it and I put it in the sink, still lit. And I grabbed some clothes upstairs, came back into the kitchen, and then I thought, oh, our neighbour's going to see this wee light flickering in the house. He'll know it's empty and he'll be worried. So I looked at the clock, blew out the candle, jumped in the car and drove to Belfast. My uncle came out to his gate as soon as I got there and he hugged me and he said, "She's gone." So I started making the calls. Family, friends, arrangements, funeral, local undertaker. "Sorry to hear about your mother. Where's the family plot then?" "I don't think there is one. The old graveyard maybe." "Never heard any talk about it." "Okay then, new graveyard, new plot. What size of plot do you want? A single or a family?" "Family's for 3, single's for 1. Can you have a double?" "No, you only have 3 or 1. Now I'm 20 at this stage. I don't know, can't decide. What I'm trying to say to you, son, is, are you thinking of living around the town yourself?" I laughed to myself. It was decided that Mum's coffin would be sealed before it left Lourdes. So it was in arrivals in Dublin Airport where all those joyful Christmas reunions take place and Irish sporting heroes return to flashbulbs and cheers that I first saw my dad, and he was just broken. We waked her in our house. People came whom I didn't know because she'd done something for them that they wanted to remember. And there was great comfort in that, and happiness and laughter about things she'd done or things she'd said. All those rituals that we used to take for granted, that eased and perfumed the process of death and grieving. But I never saw her. And that's hard. I still find that hard. The last memory I have of my beautiful, kind and gentle mum is her getting on a coach in a car park in Uri, heading for Lourdes, and not even looking back, thinking her own thoughts, just on her own journey. The funeral came and went in a blur, and all of a sudden we were 2, me and my dad. 2 people who rubbed each other up the wrong way at the best of times, and couldn't speak about the unbearable loss that they'd both suffered. I felt like we were like a tricycle that had lost a wheel, and a trike with 2 wheels is kind of unstable and unpredictable. Months later, a package came from France with the death certificate. And I went through it, cause of death, place of death, time of death, and I sat in our living room and I wondered, what was I doing when she died? 10:45 p.m. But of course we were an hour behind. And then I felt the hair stand on the back of my neck as I realised she'd passed away at 9:45 Irish time, precisely when I looked at the clock and blew the candle out. Her candle. There's an official framed group picture of them all with the Dromore pilgrimage, and it's faded and yellow now. And you can see my dad squinting into the sunlight in front of the basilica, and Mum gazing off into the distance, just unaware of the photographer, in her own world. I'm told by people who were there that Saturday night that she'd heard the lured hymn drifting in through the hospital window from the candlelit procession, and it was all very calm and very serene. And out of all the postcards that they sent to friends and family the day before she died, the only one that never arrived was mine.
It was an English woman who first mentioned her. The girl, who had arrived at Lake Arrowhead as the nanny of a rich family from New York, about to vacation near our modest cabin, sounded like Mary Poppins. To top it all, she was reading Pride and Prejudice. I was 8 years old and asked this grown-up, who must have been all of 19, what prejudice meant. She never even tried to explain, but did mention the author's name, Austin, sounding to a child brought up on Westerns the same as a city in Texas, one as mythic as Fort Worth or El Paso. Only Jane Austen, who died aged only 41, was neither an outlaw, adroit gunslinger, nor a settler. And she spelled her name with an E, not an I. The childminder loved the Regency fashion and gave me sketches of bonnet-wearing women and high-waist dresses. The gentlemen favoured lofty top hats and tight breeches. These people attended balls, not barn dances. I forget her name, but realizing she had a rapt audience, me, the nanny read out passages from the novel in her cool, for us, novelty English accent. Austin's characters are talkative, and that first encounter introduced lots of lively exchanges and a quick-witted, smart-talking heroine called Elizabeth, who had four sisters. A house full of daughters had left the father depressed, and the poor fussy mother an indiscreet slave to her nerves. An eligible man was viewed as both prey and godsend. It soon became obvious that this was far more interesting than Little Women and closer to Kill a Mockingbird. In common with Scout Finch, Lizzie, or Miss Eliza Bennett, inhabited a small-town community in which social ritual meant more than simple kindness, and everyone spent their time moaning about money when not gossiping about each other and noting the slightest telltale gesture. Each face was described and their personalities were revealed by their words. It was great, almost as funny as Dickens and Sharp. I discovered irony and loved it. Imagine being able to think like Elizabeth Bennet, deliver your opinions with such fierce eloquence, and openly vow to marry for love. In Austen's Mr. Darcy and Captain Wentworth reside studies of repressed men battling their emotions, especially rejection and disappointment, using surface coldness in letter writing. Reading Austen inspires lifelong devotion. She predates the psychological realism of the 19th century Russians. Think of poor Tatiana in Eugene Onegin, or elsewhere, of the heroines of Thomas Hardy or Henry James. We think of Jane Austen, youngest child and second daughter born in a rector's family of seven children, as a shrewd commentator working from a corner in a parlour. Although marriage, or rather a financially sound marriage, a social survival for a young woman, is among her major themes, Austen was never to marry. As a schoolgirl, she had written Wild and Subversive Juvenilia. Three volumes were published in the 20th century to the amazement of Austen scholars. In them, women drink too much and men are forced to set traps to ward off their female pursuers. Then, nothing. After years of silence, she resumed writing. Between 1811 and 1817, then in her 30s, she completed six novels: Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, Mansfield Park, Emma, Northanger Abbey, and, so tellingly, darkly, Persuasion. Her brilliant grasp of comic, at times merciless satire, and timing was apparent as early as Sense and Sensibility, and triumphed in Pride and Prejudice, as well as in Emma, which showed Austen was sufficiently confident to create a snobbish heroine with very real flaws, who cruelly, if thoughtlessly, insults the hapless Miss Bates. Austen was ever alert to vulnerability, not just as seen with Miss Bates, but also most perceptively in the pragmatic Charlotte Lucas, who admits to marrying the odious Mr. Collins for security. "I'm not romantic," she says to Lizzie. "I ask only for a comfortable home." Elizabeth's initial regrets about rejecting Mr. Darcy are heightened when she views his estate Pemberley in all its glory. The practical, clear-eyed realist Austen was a confirmed battle-scarred romantic. She had to have been. How else could she create Anne Elliot in Persuasion? At 19, Anne had been joyfully in love with Frederick Wentworth, who adored her, yet all is destroyed by the well-meaning interference of Lady Russell, who attempts to guide her in the absence of her dead mother. The romance is destroyed. Anne must endure the snobbery of her appalling, spendthrift baronet father and her equally revolting older sister. Meanwhile, the youngest Elliot, Mary, has married beneath her into the Musgroves, mere gentry. Anne lives with her regrets. Wentworth reappears, a success, if embittered, in search of a wife but distant to her. Her emotional pain is extraordinarily astutely drawn, as are her efforts to regain Wentworth. Bright, clever, 20-year-old Jane Austen had herself fallen in love over Christmas 1795 with Limerick law student Tom Lefroy. Parted from Jane by financial circumstances, Lefroy became a lawyer, married well, and his wife inherited further wealth. They had seven children, the second a daughter named Jane Christmas, the period during which Jane and Tom had flirted and danced, as she told Cassandra, her sister. He lived on until 1869, dying aged 93, a Lord Chief Justice of Ireland. He had attended her funeral, bought at auction a publisher's letter rejecting Pride and Prejudice, and admitted in old age to having had a boyish love for Jane Austen. David Noakes states in his 1997 Austen biography that she loved Tom Lefroy. Speculation suggests she suffered from Addison's disease, yet Jane Austen, feminist icon, witty, intuitive, sardonic, and hurt by life, may just possibly have died of a broken heart.
Recently, I was rereading Shakespeare's take on the seven ages of man, and it got me thinking, as I assume it's supposed to do, on my own life. But that life hadn't fallen comfortably into seven cycles. At least, not yet. Instead, as I jotted down the landmarks of my own time, my life seemed to fall into six phases of 12 years, rounding out nicely at 72. Though, of course, I'm hoping there might be another rotation to come. The first 12 years are peppered with the concerns of childhood. Moving house at 5, making new friends, being forced to move school at 10 because of a teacher who was more than fond of using his fists and boot as methods of education. Seeing my brother and sister disappear to boarding schools, leaving me effectively as an only child. Heading for a three-month winter stay in the Gaeltacht at the age of 11. A bleak but worthwhile journey. Leaving primary school behind and heading in great trepidation to boarding school in Limerick, where, for a time, I walked in my brother's imposing shadow. The second phase found me settling into the enjoyment of secondary school and making lifelong friends, enjoying their companionship, starting college and again feeling lost, isolated and out of my depth before becoming involved in student politics. Spending summers working at hotels in London, a city which offered free theatre, free concerts at St. Martin in the Fields, and the entertainment of Speaker's Corner on Sunday mornings. Later, there was the challenge of a teaching career in my hometown and marriage at the age of 24. By the time I was 36, I had two children, had left my teaching job for broadcasting. Why would you leave a good, permanent and pensionable job for work in radio? My father had asked, and then added, that radio thing won't last. I had bought my first home at a time when such a thing was not only possible, but expected. But there had been losses too. My mother had died, as had friends from college and young people I'd taught in the vocational school in Castledermot. Suddenly, the world seemed a more shadowed place. At 48, I was looking, like everyone else, at the millennium, waiting for the world collapse that never came on that midnight hour. And again, my life had changed unpredictably. I had moved house, then moved and moved again. I was trying to rebuild relationships with my children. The realization had dawned in my working life that whatever else I wanted, it wasn't a managerial role. and the possibility of a full-time writing career was rolling around in my head, parading itself as a possibility. At 60, I looked back on all kinds of